Welcome. You're listening to Casually Baked, the podcast, home base for the can of curious. Thanks for tuning in.
It's a hard time. We had a hard time together. Together. Yes, it's a hard time. We had a hard time together.
Welcome to Casually Baked, where we serve up hot and fresh perspectives on wellness, agriculture, personal sovereignty, and purpose. Thanks for opening up and tuning in. I'm Joe, your host and cannabis lifestyle guide, and I'm excited to welcome onto the podcast today, Dr. Michelle Sexton. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, so we are celebrating the release of your new book, Eat, Sleep, Relax, Protect, Forget, an Endocannabinoid Guide to Systems Wholeness for Women. But men, before you tune out, this is for you as well. Anybody that's feeling stuck, this episode is going to be for you, I promise. So, Dr. Sexton, we've known each other for a while. I've recorded a podcast with you before. We did a show on women's wellness and menopause, and had really great response. And recently, you came through my sweet little small town of Lockhart, Texas, and shared a book reading and talked to some of my community about our endocannabinoid system and how, you know, partnering with nature will get us further down the road for longevity and a wonderful life. So I'd like to jump in with something you wrote in the beginning of the book. And this conversation can unfold however it does. I have bookmarked pages and topics that I want to cover. But you said, the overarching goal of this book is to reduce your allostatic load. And so I feel like, okay, that sounds like a really important thing for all of us to know what it is. So tell us what it is, and then let's dive in.
Well, allostatic load is a concept that sort of evolved over time as a result of the work of Hans Selye around stress and, you know, the physiologic responses to stress that we have. And, you know, honestly, I think we become so desensitized to stress, you know, just living in our modern world. Not that ancient peoples didn't have their own forms of stress, but we have so many new and different kinds of stress every day. And the impacts on our human health, we can now measure, you know, using laboratory analyses, as well as other things like your heart rate variability or looking at, you know, your sleep quality. So there's many, many ways to sort of assess the impact of stress on our body's physiology, our biochemistry, and therefore the impacts of all of that on our mental health and ultimately our stress resilience, or the ability to rise to a stressful situation, but come back down to our normal baseline where we should be in homeostasis, or, you know, calm and collected.
Outstanding. So Dr. Sexton is an integrative medicine specialist and a respected pioneer in the field of medical cannabis. And she has been helping folks like you and me with this for over 30 years. So I love that I have someone talking to me about this who goes about helping your patients create almost like a wellness roadmap, which is what I have been doing for myself over the last several years of just really trying to dial in the things I like to do, you know, my lifestyle, but choosing natural options when it comes to helping with things that are stressing me, ailing me, and even really things that just jive with my own DNA. When we're going to start in this conversation about stress, where do we dive into that conversation?
Well, I want to I want to say that, you know, part of what brought me to writing the book was also my own journey. And that includes my own journey with trauma and stress and being relatively unconscious about, you know, the connections. And so as a naturopathic doctor, one of our main things is to treat the root cause. And so what is the root cause? You know, is the root cause really this job that I can't manage, or these personalities, or the number of things, you know, that I'm trying to accomplish in the day? Or is it something even deeper that we haven't really thought about or looked at that, you know, is predisposing us to be a high stress person?
Yeah.
You know? And I went along unconsciously for a couple of decades without realizing the impacts of things that had happened to me in my childhood that sort of set my central nervous system up for being, you know, hypervigilant and impacted easily by stressful situations. And so getting to that root cause, and just first, the first task is just gaining that awareness of why am I the way that I am? Who am I as a result of everything that I've been through and even that my ancestors have been through?
I love that you bring this up. That is absolutely one of the pages I have marked in the book, this the adverse childhood experiences and the things that we can do to navigate finding what those things are. Will you talk a little bit about some of the things that might happen to us, you know, as a result of living with this trauma and not digging it up and letting it go?
Yeah, and I would like to preface that to say that my experience in working with patients is that a lot of people tend to minimize trauma. And, you know, when we think about it, or if you even look at the, you know, what we call the big 10 or the capital T traumas that are screened for, like in the ACEs questionnaire, Adverse Childhood Experience Questionnaire, I mean, there's a lot of people that didn't experience any of those things. Or maybe a patient will say, well, yeah, but, you know, it wasn't that bad. Well, you know, I don't think that we should judge our own experiences that way or compare them to someone else's. You know, just because a murder didn't occur in front of your eyes or you weren't being beaten physically doesn't mean that you didn't have other, you know, trauma.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of it's a buzzword right now, but those lowercase t traumas, you know, I think are where many more people may find themselves. For instance, being bullied at school is not on the top 10 list. You know, experiencing some form of racial disparity in your lifetime, that's not on the top 10 list. You know, so it's leaving a lot of things out. So I like to use that ACEs questionnaire as just sort of a door to open the discussion more. And what we have learned from studying people and even the next generation, you know, removed from a severe trauma, is that one thing that's been measured is that the cannabinoid 1 receptor tends to be downregulated. I think this was specifically in people with a diagnosis of PTSD, which, you know, many people may have, even though we've never been to war. Mm-hmm. You know, we can have other experiences that are a PTSD experience. And if you're exposed to, you know, these kind of stressful events, especially as a child, it's sort of programming our physiology to be hypervigilant for stress. And part of what happens in that stress response is, you know, we've all experienced epinephrine, that sudden jolt of, you know, like a fight or flight response. And then the adrenals are also pumping out cortisol in that situation. And so in the long term, if you're having a lot of cortisol being released into your system, the biological effects are that eventually that cortisol receptor gets downregulated. There's less receptor. And then the cortisol itself gets downregulated. And that's part of a normal stress response. And so then, you know, then, and if you've got all of this downregulated and then you come into a stressful situation or an encounter, it's almost like your body can't even, you know, rise to the occasion to manage that stress well. And then, you know, chronic anxiety and people feeling heart palpitations and feeling sweaty. I mean, there's all kinds of things that people can experience. And this is even with just like a minor stress event across the
day. So then tell me, what would be the symptom of the CB1 receptor being downregulated? Is that all of that in conjunction with that too, or is that just from the cortisol?
Yeah, so, well, in the brain, where, you know, the CB1 receptor was really first described in this situation of being a homeostatic system, and we now have learned that this is applying across every tissue where the endocannabinoid system is, and it is in every tissue, at the level of two nerves or neurons interacting, you know, we have this flow of information that's being carried by neurotransmitters. And when they reach the destination on what we call the postsynaptic side of the nerve signaling, this is when the endocannabinoid system is signaling back to where the neurotransmitters were released to say, got the message. You know, you can shut off that flow of the neurotransmission.
Got it.
And without the cannabinoid 1 receptor there in the amount that it's supposed to be there, it's losing that homeostatic role where, you know, it could lead to overexcitation at these nerve signaling impulses. And so that hyperexcitability, you know, in the brain and translating down into the rest of our body is what we think is going on.
Okay. And quick note for the listener, this book that we're talking about provides intimate knowledge of the endocannabinoid system so that we can use our own ECS as a guide to live in harmony with our bodies. So if you feel a little lost with any of the conversation that we're having today, just know that in this book, Eat, Sleep, Relax, Protect, Forget, that you'll be walked through all of these things. You'll know all of the lingo, the acronyms, what all of the words mean. And, you know, just consider it your own little at-home college course in the endocannabinoid system.
Yeah. And don't be scared by the biology. If you're not a biologist or, you know, haven't studied science, there's probably going to be terms you're unfamiliar with. I tried to always define things to the best of my ability. You know, when you've spent a lot of time in higher education, it's easy to forget that other people don't have the same vocabulary. So I really did try to make an effort to make it readable and understandable and to define things well.
Well, I think you've done a good job. And granted, it is something that you read, but then it also becomes a reference guide. If you're struggling with your sleep, pick it up, read the sleep portion, put it down. But so, yeah. So going back to the trauma and how that can manifest in our bodies if we aren't actively dealing with it.
Well, over time, you know, cortisol, it's an interesting compound. It's a steroid. It's made from cholesterol, you know, so we have to have cholesterol intake to make all of these sex steroid hormones and then cortisol is another version of a cholesterol compound. And, you know, interesting thing about cortisol is that when we wake up in the morning, it should be at its peak level. And so this is why we should wake up feeling, you know, kind of energized. Because if anybody's ever taken like the drug version of cortisol called prednisone, I mean, it just makes people completely wired. Even sometimes at small doses, people are very sensitive to it and won't be able to sleep. You know, if they're using prednisone, usually take it early in the day. You don't want to take it late in the day. And so, you know, if you're waking up feeling drained and a lack of energy, sometimes, you know, this can be a clue that maybe the adrenal glands are just tapped out and they're not really producing cortisol well. And the other thing that can happen is people maybe having, you know, enough in the morning to get going, but then their afternoon level is very, very low because, you know, the whole cycle is sort of suppressed, and then feeling very sleepy and exhausted, you know, by the time afternoon arrives. And so, you know, just getting through the day and having the amount of energy you need to get up and get out of bed, you know, and get invigorated for the day can be really challenging when cortisol production has been affected. And so that's kind of where it starts. And then the second thing that cortisol does for us is that it's an anti-inflammatory compound. One reason we may give people prednisone is because they're having a flare of their multiple sclerosis, you know, which is an inflammatory situation. And there's other rheumatoid situations where, you know, people are having to use prednisone to dampen inflammation. And so if we're not having an adequate amount of this natural anti-inflammatory in our body, then this is what we think is then leading to, you know, inflammatory conditions that progress over our lifetime until by the time we get to older age, you know, we have chronic health problems.
This is so true. And I appreciate how you kind of stair-stepped through that. You know, I think so many times people don't consider the health of their future self until those symptoms are here and they're feeling the pain, but that means it probably started 5, 6, 7 years before that. So even if you feel great every day, but you're only getting 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night, like that compounds, that kind of thing catches up with you. So, you know, we always have to consider our future selves. And I think that's one of the benefits of a naturopathic doctor and a wellness plan is that you're wired to be looking at us as the whole person. So one of the things that you touch on here that is a recommendation that you have for managing this stress is yoga. And I thought it was really interesting how you mentioned that yoga tones our endocannabinoid system. So will you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we know that there are a lot of things that tend to tone the system. And so when I talk about the word tone in general, so I'm a swimmer. And, you know, you don't really build muscle swimming. What you do is keep your muscles toned. And, you know, we need this, especially as we age. And so we're not really talking about necessarily building up the endocannabinoid system. We just want it at that level, the natural level where it should be to do its job. And this is part of where we have a relationship with plants, that plants provide this role in humans of toning systems and enzymes and things in our biochemistry. And then we also know from actual research that's been done that there are certain things that can temporarily kind of boost the levels of our natural cannabinoid compounds, our endocannabinoids. And so really anything that can help you build stress resilience is going to do this. And yoga seems to be so perfect because, you know, it's a combination of doing deep breathing along with moving the body and stretching and, you know, inward focusing, sort of meditative experience, acupuncture, massage therapy, chiropractic or osteopathic manipulation. We've measured that endocannabinoid levels rise when involved in these activities. And this is probably because, you know, they're part of our feel-good system. You know, we have anandamide, or the Sanskrit word for bliss is ananda. And so the first endocannabinoid discovered got named after that. But we're not high walking around, right? We need that anandamide to just help us feel good across the day.
And I will say that whenever I get out of a massage or after an acupuncture appointment, I absolutely feel just like I do after I've smoked a joint.
Right? I know, I get through it, my massage therapist or my body worker, and I mean, I feel like I'm in a state of altered consciousness. You know, sometimes just almost drunk, like,
yeah,
I shouldn't even try to go home yet, you know? So, you know, human touch, skin to skin contact, however, you know, whatever form you want to do that in, probably affects our endocannabinoids the same way we've talked about our endorphins, which are the opioid-like compounds in our body. We all know about this runner's high that has always been associated with the opioid compounds or the endorphins. But then we also have research showing that moderate level exercise also boosts our endocannabinoid system. So, you know, yoga probably provides that sort of moderate exercise level, and then you're building the breathing into that. And it's just a great practice for bringing you into the present moment. I mean, it means literally yoking the mind and body, and we just have to keep our mind from constantly being either in the future or in the past, because it doesn't help,
yeah,
right? It doesn't change anything in the present moment.
Absolutely. And I love that you just talk about the combination of all of these things, which anybody that practices yoga is like, yeah, no shit. But somebody that doesn't, it's like, hey, get on a mat. And it's a great opportunity to practice listening to your body and feeling your feelings, you know, and I don't just mean like your emotional feelings. I mean the sensations pulsing through your body, like feeling your chi. And in medical terms, you call that interoception. So do you want to talk a little bit about the benefits of us like dialing in that relationship?
So interoception, you know, is like you said, it's this ability to appropriately read signals from our body. And it's extremely common for, you know, people who have experience past trauma, which includes all of us, you know, to have some degree of dissociation from our bodies. And, you know, some people can have it in a very extreme way. And for other people, you know, it's more minor. But, you know, in naturopathic medicine and our therapeutic order, the first step for us in addressing health is what we say, removing obstacles to health. And so what are these obstacles? What are these entities that are disrupting our optimal health? Well, chronic stress levels and maladaptive coping, you know, are two things listed there. And so not even being in touch with what our body needs only perpetuates the dis-ease that's going to be in existence if we don't go in and try to remove all these disturbances to health. And so yoga and making a practice of it, and you get better and better at it over time, is just a means of like bringing you into the body to make you more self-aware of what's going on in the body. You know, I'd say that probably the most common example of a lack of interoception is people not recognizing when they're hungry or when they're sleepy. And then, you know, you can take it to the next level of not recognizing when a situation is too much and you need to remove yourself from a situation. You know, we tend to just think, oh, I have to manage this. I have to, you know, maintain and stay in the game. But yeah, is it wise sometimes to just say, you know what? I need to take a break. Time out. So
yeah, those are, you know, great practical
sleep,
examples.
Diet. Yeah. So interoception is something that we sometimes have to, you know, learn what it is and then cultivate it.
I think microdosing cannabis, like smoking it, is a really great way of practicing that as well, because you do really get dialed into your body. And I want to ask you, I haven't read it, but I think there's a recent study. One of my guests over the last couple of weeks brought it up, talking about how smoking is bad for us. Smoking cannabis is bad for us. I mean, we already know smoking cigarettes is bad for us. But I remember having some conversations with you where sometimes the best way to consume it is by smoking it, and it does something particular in the body that the other forms of consumption don't do. But this is a vague memory in the back of my mind somewhere, and so I wanted to get your thoughts on that study, or just if you're not sure which one it is, just in general, what your thoughts about smoking cannabis are and what benefits you find.
Two things came out like in about the last couple of weeks. And these were through the American Heart Association. And these were some posters that were being presented at their recent conference. They were both sets of data taken from databases. So, you know, that's one sort of limitation of research. And basically their findings were that smoking cannabis may be associated with, you know, cardiovascular effects that could be negative, which should not really be any big surprise, because when you burn plant material, you know, you're inhaling ash for one thing. If you're smoking a joint, you're inhaling burnt paper. You know, so these are not things that our lungs were designed to have to deal with all the time. When you're inhaling that stuff, it's activating your immune system in your lungs chronically. Well, smoke has carcinogens, you know, so whether or not it's tobacco or cannabis, the smoke itself, you know, is likely harmful to us. There's maybe an association with stroke, for instance, for certain people. And what really came out of these two studies that got reported, it looks like that, you know, it was people with cannabis use disorder that are, you know, probably chronic smokers smoking all day long that were going to more likely be impacted by these cardiovascular effects. So, you know, a workaround or a hack for that is to not smoke it, but to inhale it through vaporization. So because all the terpenes and the cannabinoid compounds are actually on the surface of the plant, there's no need to burn it. Heating it releases these compounds into a vapor. And so this is at, you know, a concentration that they're in the natural plant. When you're using a vape pen, that's at a very unnatural concentration of the compounds. But with the flower itself, you know, it's going to be more concentrated than like inhaling essential oil that you're diffusing into your room. But at this point, we think it's a harm reduction approach for that delivery form. And like you said, there could be advantages to that kind of delivery. And one advantage that we know is that everyone's lungs basically function the same, unless you have, you know, lung disease. And that means that when you inhale the cannabis, those compounds are getting delivered over into the bloodstream very rapidly and with high bioavailability. It's been estimated maybe 60% bioavailable. And within 10 minutes, that THC or other cannabinoids or whatever have reached a peak in the bloodstream, and then they get delivered out to the tissues very rapidly. It's a totally different experience from ingesting cannabis. And, you know, that's a situation where all of our gastrointestinal systems are different. And so the delivery time is more highly variable. But it's that rapid delivery, probably the amount that gets into the brain because of inhalation, that, you know, causes a very different experience.
Yeah, it's my favorite experience.
Right? You know, I like when I smoked cannabis when I was in high school, and then I quit for a very long time, about 25 years, I would say. And the first time that I ever used it again was in Austin at my friend Melanie's house. I visited her when I was there out in, she has this beautiful property in Blanco. And we were sitting out in her garden, and I guess it was just a joint or maybe a pipe we smoked. I can't remember. And, you know, I took that inhalation, and then this, you know, it's just like this rush and this flood of sensory input, you know, and being out in this garden and out in nature. And it was just kind of like this, oh, I remember this now, you know. Yeah. I stopped, and now I've found it again, and I like it. You know, this rush of sensory pleasure that you get. And like you were saying, it's that euphoria, you know?
Yeah. And especially when you have a really stressful job or a stressful day, or someone like you, where you're taking on a lot of other people's energies and, you know, emotions and the stress that they're coming to you with, having a release. You know, just being able to, like, your whole body gets to take an exhale, and it's just unlike anything else. I appreciate it so much. And yeah, it's the part of like the having reverence for the plant, you know, that's the part for me whenever I'm really stressed and nothing's fixing it. And then I'm like, oh yeah, Joanna, go microdose and, you know, take a couple of puffs and be able to come back and look at something from a whole new perspective and just from a different place. It's amazing.
I was just thinking about, you know, I have a lot of patients that are, you know, novices at cannabis. And, you know, there's often a lot of stigma about inhaling it, even when I explain about the vaporization. But I always put it out there and put it on the table, you know, to say, hey, just in case, you know, you're not getting the effect that you're looking for from using the edible, you know, for future reference, we could come and revisit that. And then it's pretty interesting how many people come back and want to try the vaporization. And it's like you said, it's something about that. Yeah, you get home at the end of the day and, you know, maybe if you use alcohol, which I don't, you know, it gets absorbed really rapidly in the stomach. And yeah, you can get a calming effect and a little buzz pretty quickly. But with an edible of cannabis, you know, it's usually a couple of hours. I think some of the drinks are a little quicker that are out there. But that ability to do that inhalation, and in 10 minutes, literally, you know, you're having a different experience.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, the drinks, there's the fast acting stuff now that, you know, you really can mimic the experience of having one beer, then two beers, you know, just layering that. And then it fades within a few hours and you're fine to drive home and you don't feel like crap the next day. So I also appreciate a good cannabis mocktail. Now, I want to ask you about something that I've been curiously looking into and plotting to do before the end of the year, and that is fasting. And because of what I've learned about how it eats your junk cells and it's basically like a reboot of your cellular system, I've been talking to a lot of people about it. So I wanted to hear from your perspective how you might suggest people go about introducing themselves to fasting.
I usually like to start slow. So, you know, a first step would be maybe starting with a few weeks of having 2 to 3 days a week of caloric restriction. So, you know, kind of maxing out your caloric intake at like 500 to 800 calories. And, you know, keep in mind that in doing this, you want to always stay well hydrated. and be mindful of activities. Like it's best really to do it on a low stress day. But the caloric restriction doesn't have as much of an impact as actually, you know, withholding food altogether. But it kind of gets you toned up for, you know, having less calories, because it can be a big metabolic shock to just jump into, you know, not eating. Time-restricted eating then is, you know, the other form of restriction where you narrow your eating window to, you know, it could be 12 hours, 10 hours, 8 hours, 6 hours of the day. And we know that this has beneficial effects on a number of things. And so that'd be one way to kind of ease into it, you know, to get your body used to a different metabolism. And then there's a lot of different ways of fasting. So, you know, one would be like a total and complete water fast. And I think you met my friend John Fennell, who came mm-hmm. with me to the book event in Austin. And he was actually working at a clinic up in Northern California that was a fasting clinic. And they would bring people in there and have medically supervised fasting, water only, and actually seeing reversal in diabetes in pretty short time periods. This is mostly type 2 diabetes, you know, that's not an autoimmune insulin dependent form of diabetes. So the body's ability to self-heal and our ability to strengthen and stimulate our self-healing and curative ability seems to be something that fasting can do for us.
I love this. I really do. I'm constantly figuring out what are the things I can control to change my genetic expression. And that sounds really fucking nerdy, but when I got my DNA run against several different things, my endocannabinoid system, diet, exercise, all of that good stuff, I learned things that you can't unlearn. And so you have to make decisions on how you're going to live your life. And so with all the genes for inflammation and 2 of the 3 genes for dementia and Alzheimer's, I know that there are very simple things that I can do to not have to even think about those things. And, you know, I average between 8 and 10 hours of sleep a night because I know like that's the best thing I can do. And so then this was something when I started learning all of the ways that we can just reboot our system through fasting. I'm like, okay, this takes more discipline, but I mean, the long-term benefits are off the charts.
Yeah. And you've just described the, you know, the second step of our naturopathic therapeutic order, which is stimulating self-healing, you know, or using the power of nature to strengthen the body. And I think this is a concept that's largely absent from conventional medicine. You know, it's all about treat the symptom or, you know, give an antibiotic or whatever, but there's not a lot of inclusion of, well, what are the things I can do to build my health up? And as you mentioned epigenetics, and these are our genes that are being expressed, right? We can't change the genes we have, but we're unconsciously doing it by the way we live. So why not consciously affect how our genes are being expressed? And so we know that nutrition does this. Cannabinoids have been shown to have epigenetic effects. You know, so probably a lot of botanical medicines and their phytoconstituents or the plant chemicals, you know, this is the role. And this is, like I said in the beginning, our relationship with plants is probably programming us or programming the genetics that are going to be expressed. I like to think of it like that with plants. Like we were taught in my school to try to use the medicinal plants that are native to your area. Why is this? Well, because they're being exposed to the light and the heat and the cold and the wind and the pollution that you're being exposed to. And so plants respond to that. They produce certain chemicals based on that kind of environmental stress. And then when we take the plant in, then it's priming our systems to rise to that stress. So, you know, plants are, for me, just a prime way of restoring weakened systems that just get beaten down by everyday environmental stressors.
So people that want to have this kind of information without having to study and figure all of this out, you know, I don't know that anybody really considers having a naturopathic doctor that's in, you know, in the Rolodex, somebody that they go and see when, you know, things are acting up. I mean, we're used to having a general practitioner. So I guess for me, I want to know, can my naturopathic doctor be my general practitioner?
You know, it depends on where you are, in what state you live, you know, what are the licensing requirements, et cetera. Are naturopathic doctors licensed? I was trained in Washington State, where naturopathic doctors are fully integrated into the medical system. We have prescriptive authority. Like, we can prescribe almost anything in Washington State. And then I moved to California, where I'm licensed. They say we're primary care providers, but insurance won't reimburse us as primary care providers. You know, so there's just games that go on in the healthcare system, and it's different in every state. In Washington State, I was fully a primary care provider. Somebody could choose me as their primary care provider, and insurance paid. I do have insurance paying me some here in California, but I don't have this prescriptive authority. And so I tell patients, for your insurance purposes, you have to choose a primary care provider. And you really do want that person, because what if you have a need, like, you know, a sudden onset of a urinary tract infection that starts moving to your kidneys really fast? And, you know, you really do need an antibiotic in that situation, in my opinion. So you want that doctor on call for you. But for everything else that doesn't need pharmaceutical treatment, you can come see me, or, you know, see your primary care doctor first. And if, you know, you want an alternative solution, then make an appointment with me. So, you know, hopefully we can have a mutually respectful relationship with these primary care providers, and that, you know, people's desire for the type of healthcare they want can be respected. But naturopathic doctors are not licensed in every state.
You know, that really surprises me that California, the way they present, that a naturopathic doctor couldn't be a primary care physician. But yeah, I totally get it. Healthcare is a racket. And I guess that's why I'm like, I just feel like I trust this system more. And, you know, granted, they're great doctors. I know a lot of really great doctors. I just think they are in a system that they don't get to control.
Yeah, I just find a lot of patients are weary of just getting a prescription. And like you said, they seem to be very interested in natural, what's natural, you know? And so they want to prioritize non-invasive means, you know, using holistic, integrative types of interventions as an alternative to just taking a pill.
Now, before we wrap up, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you think is important to share before we send people out in the world to buy your book?
I just think that probably the overarching topic is a term called modifiable risk factors. And, you know, you said something at the beginning about, oh, you know, this process may have started 5 years ago. Well, we know with some things that these processes started decades ago. And with what we know, we can now say to you in your 30s, you know, you need to be getting adequate sleep. And, you know, when 80% of women report that they're not sleeping well, this does not bode well for the brain in aging. And this is being well documented now. The same with our nutrition, the same with our exercise, our stress resilience, our mental health, all of these things, by addressing them when we're young, is going to lead to probably longevity, but also, you know, a quality of life in older age that I think we all want, whether we're thinking about it at age 30 or 35 or not. You know, you just feel invincible at that age, like nothing could ever happen. But things happen, you know? And so it's never too young to start thinking about your brain health, your metabolic health, you know, any of those things, just to preserve your quality of life across the lifespan.
Amen. And when you get to be our age and your parents are the baby boomer generation, you know, my parents are 70s, mid 70s, and you actively see the result of the way your parents lived. Like, you know, you've seen it your whole life. And so getting to watch where they are now and knowing what they've done their whole lives, if that isn't enough to kick you in the ass to like take care of these things, I don't know what will, my friend.
Yeah, right. Because you have their genetics. So, you know, yeah, look at your parents if you want to know what your health may be like when you're older. And, you know, take action now. That's my overarching message.
Amen. So if people want to follow your work, Dr. Sexton, tell us how we can find you.
You could sign up for my email list. You could buy my book. That's available on Amazon. And if you purchase it, I would just like to ask to please consider writing a review for the book. Amazon has rules around what they will actively promote, and they will not promote my book until there are 50 reviews. So I think I don't even have one yet.
Well, you're going to have mine. Slowly. Yes.
Oh, good.
Well, clearly Thank I was you. Prepping for this interview. So when I get done, I'll be able to review your book.
Yeah. Let's see, my website, you can go to ecsdoctor.com, and there'll be a pop-up if you want to join the email list there. There's more about the book there. I would say that's the best way. I'm on Instagram at dr.michellesexton. So I try to, you know, do a blog every few weeks and post things of interest on there, and eventually hope to do some sort of market research on cannabis products, you know, because it's not easy to do the clinical research. We can't really do clinical research on products that people are using out in the real world. So to collect data, we have an app associated with the book where you can actually track your own healthcare, and you could also track trials of cannabis for your appetite or your sleep or whatever you might want to be using it for.
Very cool. And for those of you that are actually watching this versus listening to it, Michelle is cozied up in her closet. When she was recording the audio version of her book, she got the microphone, and this was the best place for the acoustics. So she wanted us to have good sound today. So I just wanted to call that out, because in the beginning, she's like, this isn't going to be video, is it? And I'm like, actually, there are people that wanted to watch this. So yes. Well, Michelle, it is so good to see you again. I love that you're a fellow Texan who has the same views on medicine and nature and the planet and our place in it. It's just feels good. So thanks for who you are and what you do.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure to speak with you again, and I hope our paths cross again sooner rather than later.
I hope so too. Thanks for hanging out.
Yes, it's a high time. We had a high time together.
Gosh, Casually Baked, the podcast, was created, recorded, and produced by yours truly. Editing and sound design are in the capable hands of Jamie Humiston at PodConnex. The podcast theme music is by my highly talented friend Seth Walker. If you aren't familiar with Seth's music, you can find High Time on his album, Gotta Get Back, wherever you're buying your music these days. I know he didn't create High Time for me, but it sure as shit sounds like he did, right? I hope you'll tune in next time. Thanks for hanging out.